We've seen a lot of wild things on season 3 of the Boulle Brothers' Dracula. A cow fetus, ripped out cheek piercings, electroshock torture, and furry butts. But contestant Hollow Eve took it so far, even the censors wouldn't let you see it on TV. For all the outrageousness presented on the search for the world's next drag super monster, the one thing they can't show you is a blood-soaked tampon.
Today, Hollow Eve, our favorite post-binary drag socialist with a penchant for anarchy who revels in the beauty of deviant queer art, joins us to take a look at a very intense season 3 of Dragula. Listen as Hollow chats with us about the most terrifying things about being on Dragula and what does an ideal drag community look like.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
What's so funny?
Oh, just remembering something.
Today's Feast of Fun podcast is made available free to the public without any commercial interruption. Please consider making a donation at feastoffun.com/donate or become a paid subscriber at feastoffun.com/plus to support this podcast you love.
Hello.
Hi, is this Hollow Eve?
This is Hollow Eve.
Hi, Hollow. This is Fausto.
And Mark from Feast of Fun. How are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
We're doing fantastic. You know, you're my favorite post-binary drag socialist with a penchant for anarchy who revels in the beauty of deviant queer art.
Well, thank you.
But it's not a competition.
Yeah, I think my excessive title leaves me singular in its definition.
That's a mouthful.
It is a mouthful, and I kind of did that because I wanted to dismantle binary drag tropes. So a lot of people look at it and they take the socialism very literally, the anarchy very literally, without even questioning the fact that they blindly accept monarchy.
Oh, wow. I like where you're going with all this.
You know? So you're trying to get rid of the queen part of drag.
I'm not trying to get rid of it for anyone else. Okay. But for me, I didn't want to be a king or a queen.
One of the origins they think of the word drag queen is that queen was actually spelled Q-U-E-A-N, which was an effeminate man, or they would say a woman who got around a lot.
A woman of loose morals.
Well, I hate to say it like that. You know what I mean?
Popular girl.
Somebody who will fuck anybody who the fuck they want to fuck. You know?
So, yeah, Mark, this is a family show. You don't have to be so vulgar.
But, you know, things get misspelled and they get reinterpreted. And sometimes the meaning of things get lost.
Oh, of course. Yeah. In approaching Hollow, I wanted Hollow to be a space that was empty, actually. I wanted it to be a space. And I don't think of empty as a negative. I think of it as an endless amount of opportunities. Mm. So as a space to be filled, which is also a very cheeky pickup line where I go, hi, I'm Hollow, a space to be filled.
Oh, and you fill it so well.
But I do like the, you know, this was my third drag persona, and I wanted a limitless amount of possibilities. I just wanted to feel absolutely free to create, to step into roles that were more masculine, roles that were completely genderfuck, and roles that were feminine.
Can we talk a bit about these drag incarnations? Because some people, they're just so married to what they are as a drag queen, it's never going to change. Then other people are just like, I killed that bitch off and now I'm this new person.
Well, I got started in drag during college. So it was kind of, I was very much so a full-time worker and getting a double degree. I didn't have the most time in the world to be doing drag as well, but I did have quite a few moments where not only was I super inspired by going out in the San Francisco drag scene in the early 2000s, I had a couple moments to do some political numbers as a drag king, and I was making satirical use of Rush Limbaugh, and my name was Rush Limber.
Lick it up. You know what a limber is, right? Like, for the listeners who don't know that, in Puerto Rico, that's where what? I'm from, is a frozen Kool-Aid that you lick on a hot summer day.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's a nice snack.
Wow. I didn't know that. I was just thinking of it in the sense of my own flexibility.
Drag artists, in essence, are about transformation and also sort of empowering themselves by sabotaging or transforming hurtful ideas or images or sounds. And certainly, like, using that Rush Limbaugh audio footage is really wonderful.
Yeah, it definitely was something where actually the very first number I did with a drag queen who at the time in San Francisco was named Venus Envy. And she sang, we sang a duet, and she was Marilyn Monroe and I was Rush Limbaugh. And we were singing a rewritten version of Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend. And we sang Sedatives Are a Girl's Best Friend. At the time, Rush Limbaugh was addicted to OxyContin. And I didn't mean to make light of people's journey and struggle in any capacity with substance abuse. You know, at the time we were able to put a lot of amazing political references in to kind of his own kind of standard for this like ideologically American dream kind of perfection world and his really conservative views, which canceled so many people. So we were able to make quite a bit of satirical fun of him.
Well, he's also a greedy jerk.
And hypocritical. It's a hypocrisy, right?
Yes, absolutely, on every level. And, you know, we were able to deconstruct some of that in the song and also, you know, to take his negativity and, like, flip it into a more political and fun and or making fun of way. So I don't know. It was definitely a really interesting experience, but it was my first experience with drag, although some people remind me that I started doing the Rocky Horror Picture Show when I was 14 years old, the cult show. And so, like, maybe that's really my introduction to drag, but I certainly didn't have a drag persona at the age of 14.
Well, that's where all good drag queens come from, is the Rocky Horror planet.
it is an amazing planet, and one that introduced me to John Waters and Divine and BDSM and a million other things. So it was definitely life-changing to have been a part of that production at such a young age.
Well, we loved your ideas and your drag and your sensibility on the third season of Dragula, the search for the world's next drag supermonster. And I can imagine that when you were invited to come on the show, that you might have had a little bit of trepidation.
Yes.
I mean, they were shooting, they were stabbing, tattooing, you know, in this season, gosh, what didn't they do to the drag queens?
You know, it's, that was not at all what I was scared of. the exterminations were not something I was actually particularly afraid of.
Because I noticed that, especially in the scenes where you're with the other contestants, that tensions ran really high and you guys got into very deep arguments about pejorative language and boundaries. Can you talk a little bit about that?
I personally am someone who comes off as very intense. I think that once the show started, and in the first episode, you hear me talk about the language of fish and talking about it. I'm not here to cancel people who use that language. I'm just here to present that there are many people who don't even know that it has negative connotations. And that it is hurtful to many people, and it is transphobic, and it is misogynistic, and there are a lot of people who hold that word as something sacred to them. And it's not my opinion that this is a hurtful word. It's my experience. And it is someone else's experience that it's a positive word.
Well, certainly, like, Christian fundamentalists use the fish as a symbol of their Messiah. And mm-hmm. That has pagan origins for the shape of a woman's genitals. That Jesus fish on all those Republican bumper stickers is a vagina fish.
Well, I
so it is interesting, like, because, you know, in the last 5 or 10 years, there's been an examination of that specific word, and it's interesting how, like, Christians are, like, you know, whistling, using their fish to represent Jesus, and not realizing that they're actually borrowing a feminine symbol of the goddess.
Wow, I hadn't even taken it to that location.
There's so many other layers underneath that mm-hmm. layer. And it's, to me, it's like, that's what drag is mm-hmm. so exciting, because it's like an onion
yeah.
that when you peel mm-hmm. one, you find another one that was very unexpected.
But we've all been sitting there in that audience, though, too, where you have that drag queen up there who's using that as a pejorative and absolutely trying to humiliate women in the crowd. And it's, you know, you're cringing, they're cringing, that person's humiliated. You're just like, why are you even going there? And the misogyny is so ripe. And when people, you know, sure, you can use that word fish and stuff like that. But, you know, we understand how you're using it, your tone, your intonation, all that mm-hmm. kind of garbage. So don't act like it's like this, like, nice, funny little thing to do, you know, unless you're saying it as a nice little funny thing to do.
Yeah. And it's also that so many people didn't even understand the undertones of it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people have reached out to me in that capacity where they mm-hmm. were like, I never thought this word had this meaning or that it came with this trail. But if you have had been in a dressing room, I do a number, one of my favorite numbers I've ever done. I hand sculpt a pussy mohawk onto my head. and I do this song called How Does My Cunt Taste by a band called Queef, which is a fabulous punk band. Mm. I've been backstage so many times where I legitimately hear drag queens say, ew, that is disgusting. Is there a vagina on your head? And they, like, simulate throwing up, you know, and it's just,
you're like, hey, I'm standing right here.
I'm standing right here. And also look at this dressing room that's filled with other people who have this, you know, and it's been a, it's a hard journey for everyone yeah. to unpack what it is we're handed when, you know, when we're young, what we're handed by our families and our cultures and the wider world about what our role is when you're born into the body that you're born into, mm. you know, and those are things that we all have to unpack, that it takes all of us working on unpacking them to get to the space where we can empower one another. And it's a constant struggle because that imagery and those roles are asserted onto words. They're asserted into everyday structures of life. It's quite the journey to unpack toxic masculinity for everyone. And it impacts everyone.
Hollow, what scared you about being on Dracula?
I think that probably just, I don't even watch television.
Yeah.
I certainly do not consume reality television. I find reality television as a medium to be a pretty toxic thing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of studies that have been done on it being bad for audiences as well.
We're the biggest hypocrites because we interview so many reality TV stars, but we're like, this is destroying the world.
Well, and I think that one of the hardest parts about reality TV is simply that it's called reality TV, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's manipulative unto itself, because the whole world could say, oh yeah, we know it's nothing's real. We know that it's actually a show. But actually, just by calling it reality, that there is actually manipulation and the human brain is already receiving it as real because of what it's called. Mm. And that to me is like just a mind fuck. Mm. I think it puts a strain on the audience that is extremely uncomfortable. So I've never particularly enjoyed reality TV. However, I was friends with so many people who had been on Dracula, and I had so much respect for their art, and I had performed at, you know, Queen Kong, and had been kind of a little bit more immersed in the world of Dracula for about a year and a half leading into being cast on the show.
So the competition was the hardest part about it.
I think that to me, I know who I am, and I know that who I am rubs a lot of people the wrong way. And I know that regardless of wanting to be post-binary, that I am very polarizing. So I say things and I have hard conversations, and that to me is more valuable than competition. I'm not actually interested in art as a competition at all. I'm interested in making art and doing what it is that I need to do.
What would be like an ideal television program for you?
You know what?
If you were producing one.
If I were producing one, I would produce a show that did nothing but showcase queer family building. I think it's our superpower. I think the ability for a whole community of people who have been rejected by their families, or many have been rejected by their, you know, their blood family and their bloodline, that, you know, the way that we build new families and create strong ties and bonds and have to create our own sense of pop culture because we're not represented within, you know, mainstream pop culture. And I think that that's something that drag does an amazing thing at. So I would be more interested in watching the process by which, you know, queer artists bond than watching a competition. Or if I was watching a competition, I would be really interested in seeing the entire season compete to the finish line.
Yeah, that's the thing about like when Dragula succeeds, it's because the contestants are talking about their feelings in a community spirit. And Mr. Rogers, you know, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood had a really interesting
Mr. Rogers.
Great idea about television. He said, you know, there is this this underlying value in television programs and producers that conflict and violence has to occur in order to get audiences to watch, because they're at the center of dramatic tension and plot development. But he offered an alternative idea, saying talking about your feelings and processing those feelings with other people can be just as powerful, even more powerful, and make even more engaging television than, you know, having somebody yell at somebody because they disagree or actually fighting with each other.
I absolutely 100% agree with that. I think one of the main ways that I'm always going to go back to capitalism. I am an anti-capitalist, but I do participate in capitalism because I am an American. You know, one of the ways that it manifests itself so toxically in the United States of America is that we actually have created a structure by which we do not, we are not encouraged to process our emotions. We're encouraged to shop them away.
And you can shop at feastoffun.com/store.
Get your DragCon. Go to DragCon and the Dracula store now, and then everybody can shop around instead of 20% off.
I have a lot of trouble creating merch because I like the sourcing of all of the stuff, like really like makes me upset.
we produce some of our t-shirts here, and it's like it's Fausto and I on our kitchen table making screen printing some of our t-shirts.
I'm all about that. I'm actually having all of my needles that I've ever put in my body on stage cast in resin, and I'm doing that with a friend.
Ooh, that's fun. So I know competition, you know, it sucks. It can be stressful. It's not what this world is about. But do you feel as though during the show that it pushed you to be more creative, or how did the competition affect you?
I don't know what more creative is. I already find myself to be a very creative person. I think what it does is, it gave me assignments, you know, and I think that's always an interesting exercise in creation for artists, because when I might not have ever created some of the things I created if they hadn't been assigned to me, which pushes me to, you know, explore different storylines and different ideas, you know, in my art, which I always think is a healthy practice. So yeah, in some ways I never would have probably, you know, done an Elizabethan gender fuck vampire, you know, and maybe I never would have made my guar armor, which is kind of like a high school fantasy as well. it pushed me to try new things. There are other things that I learned a lot from, that you didn't get to see, you know, that would have come later on the show had I stayed longer. But I was not particularly interested in, I didn't set my goal to winning, which is something that, I've always approached competitions and not thought about it as a competition. I think it's hard when you're living and constantly living in it to separate it the way that I had been able to do with pageants in San Francisco. There was a pageant I actually won where I wasn't on stage to receive the win because I forgot it was a pageant. so like I just felt so good about what I did that I just was like so disconnected from what was happening in the space. Go ahead.
I remember a few years ago I was watching one of the Real Housewives from New York City do a little interview, and she did a little blog thing, and she was talking about you know, she's grateful for all the fans of the show. She loves the fans, but I wish they would stop asking us to not talk about each other behind our backs, because that's the whole point of the show, is to talk about each other behind their back. And so after you got eliminated, in the next episode, you know, they talk about you and the other person who they think would be back, and what's going to happen. How did you feel about that when you heard what these people were saying about you?
I mean, they all get to say whatever they want. I appreciated, you know, Landon, you know, stepping forward and defending my voice. because I think that, you know, not everybody is ready to hear someone so passionate speak. Not everybody feels comfortable responding to someone so passionate speak. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I think, you know, that's not necessarily something I want. I don't want to end conversations. I would like conversations to actually happen. You know, so I, you know, to each their own. I don't have any negative feelings about any of the cast members who talked the next episode. I love them. I legitimately love them. They're my family.
Well, it was so refreshing and wonderful to see you and Landon, regardless of your gender identity, your feminine energy, you know, on this reality, on the boys club of drag TV show competitions, it was such a great element that it just threw out the window the whole idea that RuPaul's Drag Race has to only have gay men on the show. And to me, it's like, I'm glad that you are among the first as a pioneer, just because of the fact that you're so humanistic and progressive in your values about your drag art.
Well, thank you. there are a million things that I could say about, you know, about RuPaul.
Let's hear it.
You have a half an hour.
I have a half an hour. That's not enough time. No, it's perfectly fine. You know, RuPaul is somewhat of a hero to many people, you know, and a hero to many drag performers, and, you know, an idol to so many people as an actor and an actress, and, you know, really, you know, put a lot of visibility in the world. But, you know, for me,
rules, we know RuPaul's awesome, but how does he suck?
the rules that RuPaul created clearly come from a place of trying to control an industry in order to remain relevant. And there's a lot of fear in those rules, the fear comes from, you know, feeling like other people will be more beautiful than Ru, you know, and other kind of weird ideas, like
So interesting. So you think RuPaul subconsciously fears that other people are going to be more beautiful than him, and so he structures his world and his shows, his whole life, to never be usurped or never be in a subservient position?
Yeah, it's a very toxic place of control. And like, it's funny because it seems so, like, there's so many ways in which they try to present Ru as so enlightened, as someone who's gone beyond these things. Yeah. And it's evolved. It's so evolved, and it's just so crystal clear that they haven't been able to let go of control to allow a diversity of storytelling to make the quilt of drag as diverse and representative of the community as possible. But that also comes when you decide to follow the capitalist stream. The growing audience for RuPaul's Drag Race is not queer people. It is straight people.
I wonder if RuPaul's Drag Race embraced more diversity than would we have a show like Dracula. I always sometimes explain to people that it may be a good thing that RuPaul isn't catching on, because it gives us an opportunity to do something very unique.
Well, what you do is you build the thing right next to the thing, right? Mm-hmm. You don't try to destroy the thing, because that laid a huge amount of groundwork, right?
Yeah.
Simply build something new next to it, and you show the possibility of what future iterations can be, right? Mm-hmm. So like you're that. Always, what we're always doing is we're building a structure next to the old structure to try to move ourselves forward. You know, and to me, you know, people are starting to feel this kind of, you know, disconnect, and like words like queer, you know, are coming forward, and people are trying to wonder, are starting to wonder how to capitalize on that. But you can't capitalize on it in the way that you used to, right? Mm. And to me, drag is a reflection of the queer community. Mm. But what drag in the RuPaul world has become is a reflection of itself. So it actually no longer reflects the community. It just reflects itself. And I think that that is like a snake eating itself. It's not, there's nothing healthy about that. And so, you know, creating more diversity and growing the show and making sure the show and drag as an art form continues to reflect the community that we're in. I mean, drag was always really diverse. You know, it was more diverse than people know. Of course, I'm coming from San Francisco, where that's actually true.
I do observe that, and especially in girls who have been on RuPaul's Drag Race, is this idea that someone's going to be coming behind you on the stairs. I don't know if you've seen the movie Showgirls.
Yes, I have.
There's always someone younger and hungrier behind you coming down the stairs, ready to push you. And so there's this idea, and I first heard this from Manila Luzon, but I've heard it from contestants since then, that they fear losing their relevancy or this once in a lifetime opportunity. And so they're sometimes eager to burn bridges, not because to isolate themselves, but to make sure nobody else gets over that bridge that they got over. From time to time in our personal experience, whenever we've helped somebody get on RuPaul's Drag Race, either directly or indirectly, that they're in some ways very anxious about that opportunity. And then they're ready to, you know, make sure no one else gets that opportunity.
Which is counterintuitive, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's this idea. I think capitalism is that, you know,
I got mine, and
yeah, that's
what anybody else to get theirs.
Regardless if you're a Democrat or a Republican, there's this idea of being a regressive, which is somebody who fears other people having the exact same thing that you have because they'll diminish the value of what you have.
Yeah, and I think that that's actually not true.
Not at all, yeah.
When we live our lives in fear, because that's fear-based action, that we don't ever progress, and we won't reach that, you know, that place where what we do has a value greater than money, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure.
Everybody in the world is a totally unique individual that has never existed and will never exist again. There's no such thing as I'm the first. We don't have to be colonial with art. If it hasn't been done through your perspective, it's never been done through your perspective, you know? And adding to the quilt and to the pop culture of the LGBT community, to me, is the most valuable thing, right? Because I want to see that diversity. I want to see people's story. I want us to be able to listen to each other's stories and, you know, create a space to make a pop culture that still doesn't exist in the mainstream. And to me, that's what drag has always done. It's provided a place for the queer of mind and the whole community to, you know, come together and create that sense of connection through storytelling, which is the way the human brain was formulated, right? Our brain has grown through language. It has grown through storytelling in all of its mediums, which is harnessed through art. And here we are. Drag is bigger than what people think it is. It's often diminished by the art community and by art scholars. I've actually had PhD art theory students come to me and explain my drag to me as if I don't know what I'm doing.
Welcome to my world.
Fausto has an MFA in performance art too, and back in the day in the 90s, he'd do these drag things, and they're like, drag is not art. It's lowbrow.
Well, this really wonderful insight that I got from a friend of mine. It says most artists, they deal with the word is esoteric or rare or obscure ideas. But when you're a person who deals with popular culture as a topic in your art, everyone has a window of reference to that. And so they're going to be imposing their values and opinions on what you do, as opposed to describing their feelings about what you do. And so, for example, if I was an abstract painter, I'm not going to get the same kind of oppressive feedback from somebody that if I'm doing a musical based on the lesbian overtones of Laverne and Shirley. You know, everybody's watched Laverne and Shirley, and so they're all like, oh, well, let me tell you this, you know, well, Lenny and Squiggy, they were the underrated. I don't know why you didn't do it that way. And that's really, like, you know, at the core of social media commentary is this idea that an uninformed opinion is equal to the artist who's making that work.
Yeah. Well, but also if there isn't a pop culture that represents the LGBT community, part of what's being, you know, created is actually totally fresh pop culture. So, like, in itself, drag doesn't necessarily, for me, have to reference pop culture at all times, but it does create its own layer of pop culture. I think of the performers that have changed my life from San Francisco, just seeing their art. I think about the performers now that I'm traveling more and I get to see these communities. What they're doing is unbelievable. And I've kind of come up with this idea to try to start connecting the queer communities, you know, that I'm traveling to, because some of them are implementing such incredible structures and ideas to create more inclusion and to have healthier drag scenes, I just feel like this information should be shared, that small rural areas are doing amazing things to be more inclusive, because often they only have one bar for everyone to go to.
Paula, will you, a correspondent for us? I absolutely love you, and I love all these ideas that you have. I just feel like it's so wonderful to have this conversation with you about it.
And I love your idea of, like, what does a healthy drag scene look like to you?
Well, I'll start with a healthy club night.
Okay.
I want to go to a club and I want to laugh until I cry. And then I want to cry because I was moved. And then I want to dance until my spirit is free. Mm. I want this community to provide spaces for emotional processing. And that emotional processing runs the gamut of emotions. We're not just laughing. We're also feeling uncomfortable, or we're feeling like our heartstrings touch that make something vibrate in us that made us sad once. And then we're just there and we're moved. And when we are emotionally moved together, we just allow each other to feel more. And to me, that undoes toxic masculinity for everybody, because it creates a space where we're allowed to laugh and we're allowed to cry and we're allowed to hold one another through that. But it also means that sometimes the shows I produce become really problematic and people don't want to come to them because they're afraid of this experience.
They'll feel something.
Yeah. I found that my shows were always more successful if someone else was producing it, even if I was helming it on the helming it on the conceptual level. Mm. You know, I put on a show at the Stud last year called The Church of Nihilism, where we use the tropes of the Catholic Church to destroy gender roles.
You're a very good Catholic.
And so and there were people literally sobbing in the audience. And it was, so, especially if you were raised Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I went to all-girls Catholic school, you know, there's so much to unpack in the land of religious oppression on queer people.
Hello, let's talk about the outfit you wore on Dragula. Your costume made out of feminine hygiene products.
Yes.
Tampons and pads. One clarification I want to make, because, you know, it is Dragula. Why wasn't there any blood on the dress?
That comes from American television laws.
It is TV laws.
So, like, Tampons and maxi pads are equated to diapers and human waste. And all human waste on television must be represented by blue liquid. So if you watch a commercial for a diaper or for a pad or a tampon, it can only have blue liquid. And I believe that was expanded to purple liquid as well. But no other color can touch those products. And that would be true for brown or yellow to touch a tampon or a pad.
Hala, was this a restriction that was placed on you or the one that you placed on yourself?
This was a restriction where I was told about the rules and I could have chosen to break them. Had I chosen to break them, the outfit would not have made it on television.
So it's the same, because I think Manila Luzon did a similar dress.
But because her dress was red and there was red on the maxi pad, she couldn't have it on that show. And that's American television laws.
So that is so wild, because a show like Dracula, where you have people stabbed and there's fake blood all over the place. I don't know. Is there fecal matter?
It's ridiculous.
There's fecal matter on, like, being represented in the show.
Oh, I'm sure multiple times.
Urine,
you know,
and in the blood. This one thing, that this is the most shocking thing, is the menstrual flow of a woman's body.
But it's also like, and here's one of the things that was a problem for the show. So I did make a public apology based on, you know, how the show was released about wanting to expand the definition to include all bodies with vulvas, because non-binary AFAB people have vulvas and trans men have vulvas. But it's also a problem in this world because, you know, when talking about these processes, it's very triggering to the trans community. It's triggering, you know, it can be very triggering. So I just...
Talking about feminine products is harmful or triggering to trans people?
I would say that the hardship of connecting body parts to gender is negative to the trans community.
Okay.
That this inherently connects body parts to gender. And, you know, I fell into that as well. You know, there's part of, you know, I always say all pronouns spoken with respect. And even now I'm starting to shift my pronouns because the experience of being on the show doesn't make me want to accept she and her, because they're being used without respect toward me.
So you have a lot of other pronouns then?
Yeah, well, I've always said all pronouns spoken with respect, and I feel like I've always had close people in my life that have used a variation of pronouns that has made me a very happy person. So I've felt very held and very loved being referred to as they, them, he, him, or she, her, and or it. I've always, you know, as long as it was spoken with respect, I accepted it because... you know, I felt very disconnected from any one gender. I feel very gendered by my breasts, and my breasts very much so identify me as to many people as a woman. And I have really bad asthma, and I spent a huge portion of my youth binding. And then there was a time when I could no longer do that because I had pretty much hurt my lungs again. And, you know, my breasts are so large, and it's like, you know, I don't care if I say this, my breasts are size H. It's just like, even when they're bound, they're there, you know? So I had to come to a place in myself where I was okay with them totally free. And part of my process of freeing myself on stage has been allowing my fat body and my breasts to hang free, because it's about my own process of unpacking, you know, my own gender identity, and also freeing my fat body to be loved by myself, you know, just by me. I don't need anyone else to love my fat body. I need me first and foremost to always appreciate, love, and take care of my fat body the best ways that I know how. You know, I think that the hard part once we got into, you know, the show was that because I took all pronouns spoken with respect, suddenly I was in an environment where all I was a woman. you know, and I was only she, her. And that was very specific. And the feeling and experience of filming the show, you know, it's a very hard thing to do. It's a very intense schedule. There's a lot of hardships around it. And, you know, just the mental, by the time I got to that episode, I kind of felt like I had this flaming sword and I was just screaming, you know, and I couldn't, you know, particularly see outside of this need to just put these on the screen, like the frustration of the fact that I couldn't just wear this. And, you know, the frustration of the dirty tampons with, you know, Dahlia, and the frustrations of, you know, kind of the rules, you know, and also all of that just kind of brought me to this point where I became very singular minded about everything, and, like, you know, being told what the rules are and then further researching the rules and understanding what they were. I went on the show and, you know, I just wanted the outfit to be seen. And that was it. You know, I could pour blue liquid over myself, but I don't feel like conflating blood with piss and urine. And I also don't feel, you know, like I should have done it another way.
Is there any chance that you'll recreate the dress and photograph it, but this time with blood?
There's a strong possibility. I've started saving my tampons yet. If you're listening, Tito, there's tampons in our freezer.
my roommate. How many roommates you got?
I just live with one roommate.
One less now.
Yeah, he's a drag performer.
He's like, what's in the icebox? It smells delicious.
He's used to it, though. Like, I used to come to this place in LA, to his place, and leave, like, pig hearts and organs in his freezer all the time.
Oh my god.
So my freezer's always filled with performance art piece things.
Have you heard about 18-year-old Caroline Macher? She did a video and she's like, guys are so clueless. They have no idea that girls eat their tampons after they're done with it to reabsorb all the blood that they just lost. And then all these other girls are like playing her soundtrack saying this and like showing it to their guy friends. The guys are all like, what? Huh? Because guys are just, you know, there is, you know, clueless. You hit it spot on when you talk about period, menstruation. Right now, I mean, there was guys that just turned this podcast off already because it's just like they just cannot handle women talking about menstruation or periods, tampons, any of that stuff.
I think our audience is a little bit better than that.
Most our audience, but there's some randos that just tuned in that are just like, oh no, skip ahead.
Yeah, the looky loos, the non true believers of Dragula.
There's, you know, and it was made very clear to me that the Boulay brothers don't agree with this law. You know, they're not in any way in alignment with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
That they would welcome that onto television if the law didn't exist, you know. And part of me, you know, wishes that I'd just gone forward with the look and they had to blur the whole thing out and make all of America go, what was it? You know, yeah. Or all of the world go, what was Hala wearing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But also that, you know, just putting them on there and doing it in the way that they could be seen was also, I think, effective. There's a level of privilege if you can't see them as receptacles of blood, you know, and not all women menstruate. So like, and that's, you know, it's not a defining quality of in any way, shape or form of being a woman. It's much more expanded beyond that. And I think that the hard part of that episode for me watching it was the language I used around it, where it really just, I went in on the woman thing, but also I've come to a place where, you know, I feel like my record and my activism and what I do speaks for itself. So
I read your apology on Facebook, and I thought it was, you know, it is important to remember. It's just, people have periods. you know, and some you might identify as a woman, non-binary, trans, whatever. It's just you have to recognize this.
For those who flow.
And not all people, not all women have periods. Mm-hmm. Many do not. Mm-hmm. In fact, like, it's got to be more than 50%.
Well, yeah, because eventually you stop, right?
And I think for people who may not be aware of this, what we're talking about is separating the bodily process of menstrual flow from your gender identity mm-hmm. and expression.
Mm-hmm. Well, we want to encourage people to take care of their bodies, right? Because mm-hmm. in essence, we're at a time where there is a political movement to continue removing rights around these bodies. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, to me, it's a fight on all fronts at this point. You know, it's a fight for all people, and to, you know, even create more spaces where, you know, it's easier for people to have their bodies seen medically. You know, we want to create that safe space for all trans people, and, you know, for also for cis women. And, you know, we want to create spaces where people have access to healthcare, and we're legitimately removing those spaces and removing rights all the time in this country. And
yeah, it is interesting, like, you know, the more mainstream or the more wealthier a drag performer gets, the less they talk about progressive values of access to education, access to healthcare, taxing the wealthy back to the 1950s, and, you know, destroying, removing the concentration camps in our own backyards, the ICE concentration camps. Like, it's a topic that I seldom get to be seen. And that's why I was so excited to have you on the show, because I really feel like of all the drag performers that I've seen on television, you're at the forefront of talking about these very complicated, very difficult issues.
There's not a minute or moment that America has ever existed without mass slavery. Not one. Mm. And right now the world has more slavery than it has ever had.
And the idea that like the ICE detention centers are a concentration camp, and your dress, and you were bringing up this a little bit in this book that you were reading about disposable people.
What I had said was that the second I had got the topic of trash, I wanted to go after people being trash, because that's the American legacy at this point, is that we've chosen to value money more than people across the board. And like, that's how we end up in this space of needing massive amounts of slavery, privatized prisons, which have always existed since we quote unquote freed slaves. You know, even tipping is an industry of slavery. Because it actually inherently comes from slavery. You know, when we quote unquote freed slaves, we either mass arrested them and put them into prisons so that we could continue to use them as slave labor. But if they were freed and, you know, could work, they were not going to make a wage. They had to work for tips so that the white population could continue economically controlling them. You know, these are parts of our country that we just live in that maybe is not sitting in people's minds. You know, our mass consumption of goods, the impact of slavery in other countries, the impact of how we have separated and divided this country in a way in which we have kept certain people in slavery. And it's, you know, the move to break free from that, you know, it can't even be, you know, it's happening all the time, but it's about us becoming aware of it. And I think one of the things that happens is we suffer from this collection of red herrings. Mm-hmm. You know, I can say that we have, you know, I can say that this is an oppression I face, and then someone can say, well, I face this oppression, you know, but they don't cancel each other out. They're a part of the mass web. So when you start looking at these things, it's really clear that if you help, you know, and you're working actively, you know, within your community to assist and help in, aiding, trans women of color, or, actively working to create spaces that are trans friendly and are POC friendly and queer spaces where everyone is welcome. When you're actively aiding your voice and putting yourself on the line in protest, to create actual equality or to see that, come to its time. The United States defined the people as white land-owning men. And since then, we've had to adjust our constitution endlessly to define other people as people. But I don't know that providing voting rights actually makes everyone a person by the Constitution of the United States of America. And I think there's some really heavy language that has yet to be unpacked that is unspoken and unseen, but known socially and culturally by all who are raised in this country. And I, there's so much to unpack, so much for us to listen to. Like, sometimes when you're hearing someone talk about their experience, you just have to listen, me, I've had to learn so many lessons because I'm raised in this, big Italian family where everybody's loud as fuck and we talk over each other at the dinner table. And in order to be heard, you have to talk louder than the other people, So like my mode and zone for being heard is to talk louder than everyone so everybody knows to be quiet. And it takes a lot for me to undo this and to stop and listen. And more what my goal is to be a better and better and better and better listener without applying any level of red herring to the conversation, to allow people to speak their truth and their experience and to just listen to see, if there's a compassionate or an empathic point. And there always is. That you can see the hardship someone has faced as a human being,
I love all that you're saying, and it's a wonderful thing that the world needs now. When we talk about love, sweet love, love is listening to other people.
Yeah, love is holding space for people. Love is allowing the balance of what it means to be human. It cannot just be positivity. Love comes with heartache and the hardest emotions you've ever faced. It also comes with the biggest joys you've ever faced.
That's what I love about the Boulay brothers is that they're very much creating a space on that show that embraces a lot of these ideas as best as a competitive TV show can. And in a lot of ways, they also, parody other reality TV shows in the way that they talk to the contestants, like their whole idea of wanting to torture or killing you guys off is just so funny and so wonderful and endearing that it really is a delight to watch the series.
Well, I work with several DOMs, so I understand sadists.
What was your experience with like the Boulay brothers? Some of the contestants say they're very mysterious. My personal experience with them has just been like they're like a long lost best friend.
Well, I think that there's more mystery probably for RuPaul's Drag Race contestant, whereas like I'm not even sure what I'm allowed to say in terms of my NDA, but they're definitely more direct, and you definitely have a lot more interactions with them than what I understand from RuPaul's Drag Race. There's a lot more direct interaction with the Boulays for each contestant that happens on a very individual basis.
They used to be just one Boulay. Early on in the Dragula family, one of the contestants got so mad that she took an axe and cut the head off of her. And then two grew where one once was.
Is this actual mythology?
It's a mythology I came up with, but
that's your mythology.
I told them to do this.
Like, I've never heard that.
I told them this, like, because that would explain the fact that they look like each other, And it's like they're like a hydra. So no matter what you do, these vampires can't be killed.
And if you cut off their heads now, there'll be four of them.
You know how Facebook does that thing where it tags people and says, "Is this you?"
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
There's only one person I've ever been tagged as for the last 4 years, and I'm tagged as them almost every time they post a picture on Facebook, and I am always tagged as Drac. It always asked me, is this you? And has for the last 4 years. There was one particular picture where they're in these blue floral dresses that with pink wigs, where like I showed a picture to my mother and she was like, when would you ever wear pink? And I was like, Mom, that's not me. And she was like, what? And it's so wild because, like, you know, maybe 4 years ago, I was a lot, you know, I was a lot thinner, but like also like it's so strange that the moments where our faces look the same, and it's really crazy that that's the only person that I've ever been tagged.
It is interesting that like the Boulay brothers, it's Drakmorta that's being tagged as you and not Swanthula. I imagine that like because they look almost identical, that social media just gives up.
Well, you know, you know what's so funny is that drag faces frequently do look similar, you know, because like there are some similarities to makeup structure and those kind of things. So like, you know, features that are nothing alike, because I don't think that Drac and I look alike, but like, you know, features that are nothing alike can sometimes in a shot in makeup make the, you know, make the people seem similar. It's the shape of the eyeliner, it's the general darkness of their souls, you know.
I just think they're wonderfully sweet people, and I am just crazy about them, and Ian is an old friend of mine, and certainly Louisiana Purchase, Wheezy, although you guys are calling her Lulu.
I call her Lou.
That's so funny. she was like, I'm Louisiana.
Okay, Wheezy.
I super love Lou. And we knew each other via Instagram before the show. So we had messaged a lot. And I think we met because we were mutually friends with Vander Von Odd. And then you just end up seeing each other, you know, in each other's feeds. And we had talked a lot, so seeing Lou that first day was like such a good thing for me. It was wonderful. It was wonderful to walk in and see Lou there.
Well, and I think for a lot of people, you know, may not be they're familiar with Louisiana from our podcast, but it's like, you know, it's really wonderful to see just the people's personalities and storylines flow this season. On Dracula, you know, the best sound and lighting and camera and story editing so far. It's really quite a delightful series. It was so intense that it made Mark crap in his pants. And we're not joking.
We're talking about the elimination.
We watched two episodes last night. I was just like, I don't know if, first of all, we had hamburgers so like as we were watching the first
we're
one.
We're eating meat.
We're eating as we're watching this. So my tolerance is pretty high. But then I got up and I was just, you know, it was one of those situations where you just got a little bit more expected in your pants than you thought you were going to get. And I'm like, my God, did Dracula just make me shit my pants?
Oh my God.
So I texted my friend Vivacious, because Vivacious is like, you know, from RuPaul's Drag Race. She's like, I will not watch that show. That is not what drag is about. And I wrote her, I'm like, I just watched Dragula. I shit my pants. So maybe you're right. I shouldn't be watching it.
the stapling tradition is a long tradition in my drag family.
Mm. Oh, stapling money to your body?
Oh, very specifically, my drag mom, Fatima Rood, has been doing it for decades.
Are those staples hygienic? Like, aren't they going to infect you? I mean, money's dirty.
Money's very dirty. So I think that the
money? Oh, you mean on the show? Yeah. That's a prop money.
But there's a guy on
there. Yeah, it's an illustration to look like Benjamin Franklin. Oh. But by law, they have to use a specific fake money. Yeah,
I thought it was
because you can't legally destroy any tender in the United States of America except for the penny.
I was kind of hoping it was John Wayne Gacy at first, but then I was like, oh, it's not him.
But so back to the stapling of money onto your body.
my drag mother is Fatima Rood, and she is an icon of the tranny shock days in San Francisco. Yeah. She is an extreme body modification performer, performance art icon, and, you know, is in San Francisco a total and absolute legend. And beyond San Francisco, you know, there are documentaries about her, and she was more recently featured in Vogue magazine as one of the living legends of San Francisco. Mm. You know, she's a, you know, bed of nails performer who has had drills stuck through her face, and porcelain, famously put a drill through her face and put hooks through her mouth and tied up her face to make her smile. She staples the money mostly to her skull. She does adult baby go-go dancing. She's a artist. She is a fine artist. She's a visual artist. She's a performance artist. And, you know, she's an absolute queerdo. And I'm blessed to have Fatima as my family and as my drag mom. And, you know, what she has done, the path that she laid for performers like me in San Francisco is unbelievable. It's the path that I would follow. She currently lives in Portland. I'm hoping to make it up to Portland soon to make art with Fatima once more, because I think it's really important that, you know, families stay as connected as possible, even though, you know, we have moved a bit apart from each other.
Who do you talk to, most often from your season?
Maxi Glamour, probably, and, Yovska and Louisiana, Violencia. I really talk to everybody. I'm about to have a conversation with Eva after this.
Oh, Eva Destruction, who is she always was biting her lips.
Of course.
When somebody was like doing like a Lady Gaga meat dress reference, and she's just like, I'm not going to say anything. I'm not going to say anything.
I think she has Gaga on the brain, and I think that's a great thing because Gaga inspired her so much. You know, and people who inspire us to pursue ourselves are really important, no matter who they are, you know, and, you know, Gaga has been that person for so many, you know, queer LGBT youth. And, you know, Eva's a phenomenal performer, just absolutely phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And I was actually always super in awe of how she challenged herself to, you know, really push through the boundaries and rules that she had received growing up doing drag in Atlanta, you know? So I think that was, for me, it was very powerful to watch her challenge herself to break free from these rules, because watching someone challenge themselves to break free from these rules is how it leads other people down the path of doing the same thing, you know? Mm.
Amen, sister. Hollow Eve, it's such a delight to talk to you. People can follow you on Instagram and social media at Hollow Eve, like H-O-L-L-O-W.
Yeah, hollow, like a space to be filled.
Oh. And you fill it so well.
Yeah. So at Hollow Eve is my Instagram. The Hollow Eve is my Twitter. Twitter's very new to me, so I don't know that I'm that great at it. And Facebook, I kind of just left a private account.
You have so many great ideas, and it's like you have a wonderful future as a drag performer, but also as an art teacher, as a writer, as a filmmaker. I mean, I'd love to see what kind of movies you would make or what kind of class you would teach.
You know, I'm hoping all of that happens going forward. I have actually spent a long time as a teacher. So, I was a conservatory movement teacher for theater and, a theater teacher. So
that explains so much. A good teacher delights in explaining complicated ideas to others.
Oh, that is true. You know,
and I appreciate you taking time. I know you're super busy with the success of Dragula and your career, and we just appreciate you taking time out of your busy day to talk to us and to the Feast of Fun family.
Yeah, I'm grateful that you reached out to have me on your podcast. You have been wonderful. And I'm just want to say I'm also so grateful for all the people who have sent me so much love. I'm grateful for the platform I've been given by the Boulé brothers. I'm grateful for my Dragula season 3 family. And thank you so much for having me and talking to me on your show.
Of course, it was a pleasure to have you. And please come back.
Yeah, if you're ever in Chicago, let's go have some fun.
November 15th.
Ooh, it's happening.
Well, all right.
You know, it's the party hasn't been announced, so I don't know if I can announce it, but I can tell you one of my favorite looks from the show is going to be making its debut on a public stage. Dress. Nope.
Everyone's like, where's the tampon dress?
Hey, it takes a while to save up used tampons.
How delightful.
But one of my favorite performers in Chicago has invited me, and I'm really excited. I'm actually spending most of November on the East Coast, kind of just traveling around to make it easier for smaller venues to book me and not have to fly me all the way out from California.
That's a great way to do it.
Yep.
Well, good luck with everything, and Hollow Eve. I hope you have a wonderful Halloween.
And thank you for being on the cutting and bleeding edge of art.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Hollow.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. Have a good day.
You too. Bye-bye, love.
Okay, bye.
Hollow Eve lives in Los Angeles, California. The cast of Dragula is going to be touring across the country. And you can follow Hollow Eve on social media at Hollow Eve. Like hollow, like something you fill. Oh, it's so tight, but it feels so good. I'm talking about, you know, the pleasure of filling things.
I do miss their energy on Dragula season 3. They brought so much to the table, costumes and just, you know, I love people with ideas, and Hollow is a person with ideas, and its ideas are the things that change the world.
I feel like Hollow is like a sister to me, and I feel like a lot of the Dragula performers that I really click with, like Disasterina or Hollow Eve or Louisiana Purchase, are drag performers that they're in it not just for the fame and fortune, and there's, you know, it's a difficult road, but part of it is that they're in it for the adventure. Mm. They're out there to seek, you know, new forms of life and new forms of art, mm-hmm. and boldly go forward in their own experiences and connect with magical beings all across the universe. And that's what Feast of Fun is all about. We talk to amazing people all the time. In fact, we've done it for decades. If you're a casual listener, consider becoming a Plus member and access thousands of legendary, extraordinary in-depth conversations with some of your favorite drag performers and Dragula family, including the Boulé brothers, several times on Feast of Fun. And, you know, we can't do this podcast. We exist here because of the financial support of generous, wonderful people. So go to feastoffun.com/plus and consider becoming a member today, or make a one-time donation at feastoffun.com/donate.
Or visit our store at feastoffun.com/store and get yourself a Not Shaving Gives Me More Time for Misbehaving t-shirt today. We're also on Patreon, and for as little as $1 a month, you can support Feast of Fun and see behind-the-scenes action right there.
We got a new Cooking with Drag Queens episode, and only the Patreon folks get to see it. Mm. So go to Guess who? Yeah, we were like, RuPaul's Drag. Our next one is from RuPaul's Drag Race. From RuPaul's Drag Race, that they are going to be making some delicious meaty snacks on Cooking with Drag Queens. Go to patreon.com/feastoffun and check it out, mm-hmm. if you dare. Thanks for listening. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.